Words from one of the most famous 20th century poets of Syria. My voice rings out this time from Damascus, wrote Nizar Kabani in the last century. It rings out from the house of my mother and father in Sham. Al-Sham is the Arabic word for the ancient territory we call Syria.
The situation is very, very bad in Douma. Every day we...
Army kills us.
Army, bullets.
For me, it was... my whole family was against the Bashar Assad, but was secretly.
When I speak to you, the government will kill my brother because the people want freedom. No one have any weapon. No one have gun. Just we have our sound. There is no terrorist here. The only terrorist here is Bashar Assad.
So are you scared?
No, we are not scared.
Voices from the conflict in Syria over the past 11 months. That Kobani verse continues, the geography of my body changes, the cells of my blood become green, my alphabet is green. In Sham, a new mouth emerges for my mouth, a new voice emerges for my voice, and my fingers become a tribe. The powerful evocation of a nation and the many peoples of Syria there in the poetry of 20th century Syrian romantic poet Nizar Kobani. The voices ringing out from Damascus, Douma, Aleppo, Homs, Hama, El-Dib, Latakia this week tell a story of violence, despair, and death, though. Activists reported at least 50 people killed on Wednesday in Homs in a period of unrest, uprising, and violent crackdown that has lasted nearly a year and rivals the violence that marked the very first years of Syria's independence after France gave up its colony in 1946. We're going to be exploring where Syria has been historically, where it may be going. Along the way, we'll try to give you a sense of the hope, hopelessness, and vulnerability of the Syrian people. And we'll get a pro-government view of the conflict as well. We begin with our dear friend David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for our partner, the New York Times, and contributor to WQXR's The Washington Report. David joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to the program, David.
Great to be back with you.
Sourab al-Jukakli is a co-founder of the National Alliance of Syria, a pro-democracy group. He's with us all hour here in the studio. Sourab, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me.
Sourab, a word of what's going on in your country, your feelings, your thoughts.
Well, after 10, 11 months of popular uprising, we're coming to a state where the entire nation is on fire. We are at a point in time where we have dark days ahead in terms of what's happening in Syria on the ground. We are currently, every city, every town is currently under some sort of siege as part of an Assad military offensive to crush the resistance after the double veto that occurred in the Security Council.
Sourab al-Jukakli, our companion for all of this hour, he's co-founder of the National Alliance of Syria, pro-democracy group. David Sanger, take us through the timeline of Syria's emergence from the Ottoman Empire around World War I, becoming a French colony, and then becoming the nation that we know today.
Well, you know, the nation that we know today has been, you know, dominated by the Assad family and obviously run by an Alawite minority. And that is sort of the key to the issue that's going on now. As in Bahrain, you've got a leadership of the country that is playing completely for keeps because they know that should the Sunni majority take over, the Alawites, who are relatively close to the Shia, and obviously in this case closely aligned with Iran, that they're the complete losers. So in their view, this is an all-or-nothing revolution. And that's why these are particularly difficult in cases where you have the leadership run, where a minority leadership is running the country. And, you know, they look out and they see the region and they see, for example, the chaos in Iraq, where the where it's sort of in reverse, that the Sunnis are now being marginalized by the government, and after years of running the country, and they think to themselves, there is no future for the members of the government, for the elite of the military, should they lose. And I think that's why it's been so difficult to come to any kind of negotiated compromise and why Assad really has never even tried.
We're going to have a look at the Assad family and the Assad legacy in just a moment from one of our partners at the BBC. David Sanger, were the seeds of that playing for keep strategy right now planted in, say, the 1973 Yom Kippur War, the period when Syria was actually an ally of Egypt in the old United Arab Republic? Tell us about that history, and then take us to the point where Hezbollah enters the stage.
Well, you know, during the 73 war and beyond, the Syrians, as you say, played a very, very different role. But they became this oddity in which they became the only Arab state that ended up aligning with the Iranians. And that means that you've now seen these divisions play out, and you've also seen the oddity now that the Arab League has, at least in part, turned against Assad, something that I think was sort of unimaginable a few years ago. You've also seen, as the Assad regime put its hold on power together, that they have periodically survived these incredibly brutal crackdowns. And, you know, this was, what, the 20th anniversary of the uprising in Hama. And, you know, if you go back to my colleague Tom Friedman's great book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, and you read about Hama rules, which is sort of the basic rules of all or nothing in the Middle East, you understand that what's playing out here with the son is exactly what played out with the father.
Extraordinary. David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for our partner, The New York Times, contributed to WQXR's The Washington Report. Thanks, as always. Sarab al-Jujakli. Give me your last name, please.
El-Jujakli.
El-Jujakli.
Thank you.
Sarab al-Jujakli, co-founder of the National Alliance of Syria, pro-democracy group. Give us a sense of how that history is playing out today.
Well, the Syrian regime has been in power for 40 years, and yes, it's led by the Assad family, which hails from the Alawite sect in Syria, but it's not just an Alawite regime, and I think we need to be clear about this. It is a mafia-style regime that is led by the Assad family that pulls much of the base of support from the Alawi sect. However, it can only rule a country of 70% Sunni with collusion from Sunnis as well.
And all of those individuals who are a part of that, as you say, conspiracy, that sort of a racket, are basically at odds with the rest of the nation itself. Sarab al-Jujakli is co-founder of the National Alliance of Syria. He's with us all hour as we focus on the future and the present of the nation of Syria.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We're talking about Syria all this hour, trying to get behind the headlines, the rhetoric, and the UN resolutions. And we want to get your thoughts about the news coming out of Syria. You can reach us at 8778-MY-TAKE. But to understand that country, you also need to understand the family of Bashar al-Assad. Richard Galpin is a correspondent with our partner, the BBC. He reports on how the Assad family has been able to hold on to power for more than 40 years.
Outside the Syrian embassy in London, another demonstration by opposition activists calling for President Bashar al-Assad to resign. These Syrian protesters hope to see an end to a regime which they allege has always ruled by terrorizing its own people. It was Hafez al-Assad, Bashar's father, who started the family dynasty, becoming president in 1971. Under his authoritarian rule, the country stabilized, his Arab nationalism and tough stand on Israel winning respect at home and in the region. But he also proved extremely ruthless with his own people, as witnessed in the city of Hama, where at least 25,000 were killed by the security forces following an uprising by the Muslim Brotherhood.
I swear by Almighty God to keep honestly.
When Hafez al-Assad died 12 years ago, it was a smooth transition to his son Bashar, an ophthalmologist who'd never really expected to become president. At first, he appeared to be a reformer, but then reverted to his father's tried and tested ways of maintaining total control. Now faced with a serious uprising, he too has ordered the security forces to crush it at any cost, it seems.
That's Richard Galpin, correspondent with our partner, the BBC. And joining us now, Daniel Shiro, professor of international politics at the University of Washington and author of Modern Tyrants. Daniel, thanks for joining us. And you're the author of Modern Tyrants. I wonder if you think tyrant is an appropriate word to describe Bashar al-Assad.
Absolutely. Any president who orders wholesale massacre of his people, I think, could be categorized that way.
So in your book, you separate out different types of tyrants according to the ways that they use to control their people. What type of tyrant is Bashar al-Assad?
Well, as your correspondent just said, the Assad family started off, or his father started off, with an ideology. There was the Ba'athist Party. It was nationalist. It was socialist. But it's really turned into a kind of a mafia family rule, and they operate that way, and they have been for quite some time. They're utterly ruthless, and they and their cronies, and mostly people who are part of the Alawite sect, have all the benefits, and so it's become a really corrupt sort of a crime family that ruthlessly holds on to a country.
So Daniel Chéreau, as David Sanger suggested earlier, is there no negotiation with a regime of this type?
Probably not, because aside from the fact that they run this operation this way, they run their country this way, they are supported by a significant number of people, namely the Alawite minority, and also some of the other religious minorities, of which there are many in Syria. The Christian community is quite worried about what would, which is substantial there, is quite worried about what would happen if the Muslim Brotherhood took power in Syria. The Druze, another religious minority there, are worried about that. So the Assad family isn't just the immediate family. They do have support from a minority, but a very substantial minority, and those are the people who have the heavy weapons. And if they lose power, they're very endangered. So they're not there. I don't think there is any room for negotiation. I think it's going to be a civil war. It is a civil war, and it's just going to get worse.
Daniel Chéreau, professor of international politics at the University of Washington, author of Modern Tyrants. And the uprising in Syria is obviously the most serious threat, certainly to Bashar al-Assad, perhaps to the entire Assad dynasty. But you don't get to this position without some friends in the international community, and it might be stretching to say that Russia is a friend of Bashar al-Assad, but there is a question on that point of why Russia has not supported the UN resolution to condemn Bashar al-Assad and his government. Joining us now, Nicholas Gvozdev, professor of national security studies at U.S. Naval War College. And Nicholas, many are saying that Russia has not supported the UN resolution because they have protests in their own country and they don't want to support intervention against a sovereign government. Is it as simple as that?
That's the start. But it isn't limited to that. Certainly the Russians have concerns about sovereignty. They have concerns about intervention. But they also have important economic relations with Syria, with the Assad family, with the regime. The only Russian military base outside of post-Soviet territory is in Syria. They have concerns, as your last guest alluded to, strong ties between the Russian Orthodox Church and the Orthodox Church in Syria, and real concerns about what would happen to the Christian minority in Syria if Assad falls. All of these are factors that come together. And then there are factors outside of the immediate considerations of Syria. The discussion on the UN resolution takes place amidst a deterioration in U.S.-Russia relations, and concerns about what happened with Libya, and also concerns about what might happen with Iran. So it's not simply the immediate facts of what's happening in Syria, but larger geopolitical considerations as well.
Which means it's highly unlikely that Russia would change its mind.
It doesn't look likely that they would change their mind, especially with any resolution that calls for Assad to step down. The Russians have made it clear that they're happy to broker negotiations, but as your last guest also correctly pointed out, it doesn't look like there's much room for negotiation between the regime and the opposition.
That's right.
And so we do move into this condition of civil war.
Nicholas Gvozdev, professor of national security studies at the U.S. Naval War College, thank you so much for joining us. We're talking about Syria all hour. Sarab al-Jajakli, co-founder of the National Alliance of Syria. We've got about 30 seconds left, but as I understand it, according to the opposition, there is no negotiation on the point of Bashar al-Assad leaving power, right?
Yeah, exactly that. There is no negotiation with this Assad family dynasty. That's why we've seen it to be such a violent, bloody bloodbath at this point. All or nothing. It's an end game. And that's why from day one we saw bullets in the streets.
We've asked the Syrian government repeatedly to ensure the safety and security of our facilities and our personnel.
This is a doomed regime as well as a murdering regime.
The diplomacy must never stop.
This is not going to be a matter of if, it's going to be a matter of when.
We need to suspend operations at our embassy in Damascus.
Clearly, there will not be international intervention.
The Assad regime is feeling the noose tightening around them.
People don't think the outside world is coming to help them, and they simply don't know what to do about that.
We've established that the Russians are going to stand by the regime in Damascus, but what will the rest of the international community do? You hear the ambivalence and the sense of resolve, such as it is, among various world leaders in that montage of voices reacting to the situation in Syria. What of the people inside the country? We take you to the city of Homs now. It's been under siege for nearly 6 days, straight days of bombing by Syrian forces. Just before we went on the air, we spoke with Omar. He's an activist in Homs. He was using a very sketchy Skype connection, trying to tell the world what's going on.
We are under shelling. They are using aircraft and rockets. People here doesn't think about food. They think, just think, can we handle more time? Can we stay alive?
Omar, I fear for your safety. Are you safe now?
No, in the early morning, 3 rockets land in the next house to us. They targeted my house because I'm using internet satellite. But they are now targeting this satellite.
Well, Omar, we very much are concerned for your safety and the safety of your family. What is the future for Homs? Is there any end in sight?
We hope the international world do something. Yesterday, more than 21 babies killed. Where is the UN? Where is the human organization, humanity organization? I'm begging the world. Where is the humanity inside you people? Bashar al-Assad is an animal. He's killing his own people.
Omar, I can hear the shelling there in the background. We're going to let you go. You take care and stay safe.
Thanks.
You heard the words there on that very sketchy Skype line. People can't think about food or water. They're simply trying to survive. Where is the international community? Some of the words from Omar in the Baba Amar neighborhood in the city of Homs, under siege for the last 6 days. With us is Ilhan Tahrir, who's a correspondent for the Turkish daily Vatan and a correspondent for Hurriyet Daily News. He was in Syria last month. Ilhan, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Is the experience in Homs described by Omar there reminiscent of what you experienced in Douma when you were in Syria?
Exactly. First of all, I wanted to go in Syria because the whole world has been talking about it for about 10, 11 months. And I really wanted to go in and see whether the news coming out of Syria was correct. And the time I lived in 2 weeks there, it was a horrible experience.
We're also with Sarab al-Jujakli, who is a co-founder of the National Alliance of Syria, pro-democracy group. He's here in the studio. You have lost members of your al-Jujakli clan in the city of Homs, in Hama, in the city
yes.
of Hama. That was both back in the 1980s, the 20-year massacre, and more recently in this uprising, yes?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. I think every Syrian family over the last 40 years has either had somebody killed by this regime, detained by this regime, or tortured by the regime.
What's your feeling about the people in Homs right now? Because that seems to be the center of the uprising.
It is the center of the uprising for a number of reasons. It's heartbreaking. They're crying out for help to the world. And really, at the end of the day, the message is loud and clear to the people of Homs and Syria is that they are at least temporarily on their own.
Ilhan Tahrir, is Homs becoming the Benghazi of Syria right now, really the center of the opposition, and that there are two poles in the nation of Syria, what's going on in Damascus and what's going on in some of these other places around the country?
I think that the Free Syrian Army and the locals would like to be, but the regime forces in Syria has a superb power over the Free Syrian Army. I traveled quite a few suburbs in Damascus, and I met with the Free Syrian Army leaders. And I mean, I can see in Douma, for example, it's probably over thousands of Free Syrian Army members. But in cities like Harasta, which is closer to Damascus, it is fewer. And as far as I know, in Homs too, it is thousands of Free Syrian Army, but the arms they have, it's you really cannot compare with the regime forces, tanks, and all the other military superiority.
Hardware supplied in most cases, yeah, by the nation of Russia. Ilhan Tanir is a correspondent for the Turkish daily Vatan. He was in Syria last month. Sara Balcıcakli is a co-founder of the National Alliance of Syria. He's in the studio with us. Where does the Free Syrian Army get its arms? And are they terrorists, as Bashar al-Assad says?
No, these are ordinary Syrians who have defected from the Syrian army, many of which have claimed they've been ordered to fire on their own people during peaceful protests, and that has triggered mass defections across the country.
Although you've just described this sort of mafia setup in Syria, mm-hmm, where people are paid to be a part of the regime, what you're, mm-hmm, suggesting is that people are defecting from that mafia, from that sort of paid patronage. Where's the break point where people go, you know, I've got a gun from Bashar al-Assad, I report to him, versus, no, I'm going on my own?
Well, from a Free Syrian Army perspective, what we're seeing is that in front of every conscript soldier, there is a security officer behind them with a pistol aimed at the back of his head. So what's happening now is every individual, every small platoon is trying to find ways to break away. And they're trying to find their chance because they've seen their colleagues being shot in the back of their own heads when they've disobeyed orders.
That's Sara Balcıcakli. Ilhan Tanir, is that what the Syrian army members report to you, that defections, there would be many more defections but for this threat of execution?
Definitely. That's what they're hoping for. In our interviews, over dozens of Syrian army leaders in different suburbs, they know that when you compare with numbers, they are not powerful enough to face with the army members. But what they are hoping for, as the major operation that the regime has been undertaking for about 2 weeks now, is going to cause more defections, because their main source for men and arms from these defections.
Although in Syria, the history also tells the tale of the regime shutting things down with an overwhelming use of violence. Ilhan Tanir, a correspondent for the Turkish daily Vatan, and Sara Balcıcakli, who's here in the studio with us. All hour long, our focus on the situation in Syria. Stay with us. So far this hour, our perspective and focus has been on the people of Syria and the vulnerability in the face of an onslaught by what appears to be a government attempt to assault its own people. But that's certainly not the view of the Bashar al-Assad regime. Joining us now is Dr. Ayman Haidar, who's an internist. He's a founding member of the Syrian American Forum. He joins us from Flint, Michigan. Dr. Haidar, do you support the Bashar al-Assad regime, and do you have a different view of the events unfolding now in your country?
I do have a different view on what's going on. I believe that this is actually a true conflict right now between two different groups, you know, the government on one side and the armed groups on one other side. The armed groups, unfortunately, they've done a lot of bad things in Syria too, you know, including Homs itself. I have relatives and I have my two sisters who live in there. They've taken over 80% of the city pretty much over the past few months, and they were terrorizing those people in their houses. People were not able to, you know, to do their daily chores. They were not able to go to school. Kids were not able to go to schools, to universities, and other things.
Indeed, there's chaos all around, and, you know, no one's hand is completely clean here. But give an argument, if you could, to the people of Syria of why, in the face of all the change that's going on in the Arab world, why should they simply go back to the way things were and have any expectation that freedom and democracy would come at the end of it? What's that argument, Dr. Haidar?
Well, I don't think that they need to go back to where they were before. You know, there should be definitely, I mean, there is actually a huge need for reform in Syria. Everybody admits that there was corruption. There was all kind of issues in Syria that were going on. So we need to actually apply those reforms. I mean, we need to be able to do that. Nobody is asking to go back, and I don't think anybody wants to go back. I believe the majority of the Syrians, they still support this current government, and they want to go back at least to some, you know, some peaceful times just like they were before.
Why do they support this government? Why should Assad stay?
Because they believe in that government right now. I mean, I believe the majority of the Syrians, they still believe in that, and they believe that, you know, that the government has brought a lot of peaceful times in Syria.
Then what would the successor to Bashar al-Assad be? Assuming that there is some sort of democracy, where does it go? Does it pass to his vice presidency? Does it move to some other party? Could the Muslim Brothers ever rule?
Well, that's the problem, and that's what people are afraid of. I don't think people would like to see the Muslim Brotherhood in power because of their, you know, extreme religious views. You know, most of the people in Syria are moderate, and they don't believe that the Muslim Brotherhood should be ruling. And that's the biggest reason why people are afraid of the change in Syria. We need to actually do, actually push in the U.S. We should push for more negotiations. The government has asked for negotiations and dialogue, and we should push for that.
You're referring to the talks that were called for between the opposition and the vice president, which only occurred after the Russian foreign minister arrived in the country. Dr. Ayman Haidar, who's an internist and a founding member of the Syrian American Forum, speaking to us from Flint, Michigan. Thanks so much for your perspective, sir.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
We know very, very little, simply that the bombardment has resumed and it seems to be even heavier than in any of the preceding days.
I prepared my son, my brother-in-law, my brother, my nephew, my cousin, my neighbor, my friend.
I mean, there's certainly a lot of panic in Homs.
One voice that has perhaps given us some of our most vivid accounts coming out of Syria this week is Paul Wood, intrepid reporter with our partner, the BBC, one of the few reporters to actually get inside of Homs, and we have his latest dispatch here for you.
We're sitting cross-legged on the floor having a very pleasant breakfast of bread and olive oil. And Abu Yamin is telling us just how this bread got here.
There isn't any bakery here. It was hit and the workers got wounded. So they have to get bread from outside. When they blocked this area, they ran out of bread. And this friend of theirs, Abu Shahir, knew that there is no bread here. So he decided to make the suicide mission, and without telling anybody, he put a lot of bread in his car from Khaldiyya and just drove, and they started shooting at him from all directions.
This is the bread we're eating now, is it?
Yes.
The man who brought the bread is the same man who transports the injured. Those who don't make it end up with Abu Suleiman. Before the revolution, he was a building labourer. Now he works full-time as the mukaffin, the person whose job it is to prepare bodies for burial. He wraps each one carefully in a white shroud. He's done this for hundreds of people now, among them many members of his own family.
Yeah, take a deep breath, right?
Take your time. Yes, it's a very difficult job. All these people I know, all these people are my brothers. It's very difficult. I prepare my son, my brother-in-law, my nephew, my cousin, my neighbor, my friend. But somebody has to do it. And the least I can do for them is to do this job. Yeah. This is the least I can do.
Paul Wood reporting from Homs with our partner, the BBC, all week long has been helping us to understand what's going on there. And to help us perhaps understand the broader context of the future in Syria, we've got still Sarab Al-Jajakli with us, co-founder of the National Alliance of Syria, which is a pro-democracy group. And joining us now, Fareed Ghadri, the Syrian-born co-founder and president of the United States-based Reform Party of Syria, which is lobbying for regime change in Syria. Fareed, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Explain to me, when we look at the future of Syria, who are the leaders who are emerging from the opposition who might be able to, let's assume that there will be a post-Assad era, that might be able to lead the country forward?
Well, I think Syria and the opposition today has many faces, new faces, and many people that have come to the scene lately that are responsible enough, that have the background and the wisdom to carry Syria into the new millennium, or at least into the new era. It's imperative upon these leaders, and I support them wholeheartedly to take that responsibility seriously, and we hope that they will be able to achieve their goals.
Is there a need for international intervention? Can the civil war in Syria be resolved without, say, the participation of other countries or the Arab League stepping in?
I think for the last 11 months, Europeans, the U.S. especially, and the Arab League have been trying every single angle to try and stop the violence. And I think post the veto by China and Russia, everybody's coming to the realization that this is going to be an impossible task, that Assad is not willing to stop the violence, and his friends are not willing to drop him. And so, you know, being in Washington and having friends inside and outside the government, I can tell you that this debate is heated right now, and there are plans that are being drawn to actually save the country and to actually stop the violence against our people.
Fareed Ghadri is with the United States-based Reform Party of Syria, and with us all hour long has been Sarab Al-Jajakli, co-founder of the National Alliance of Syria. And Sarab, you're both with opposition groups, but help us understand, because there's all kinds of opposition groups in Syria, all with different names. Do they all also have different missions and philosophies?
Sure. The political opposition inside and outside of Syria is very diverse and represents really the diversity that is the Syrian nation. You have everything from leftists all the way through conservatives. And I think externally you have this network of technocrats who have come together under umbrella and have created things like the SNC, the Syrian National Council. You have on the inside activists, local grassroots activists who are coordinating the peaceful pro-democracy protests throughout the nations, local coordinating committees who are coordinating responses of their towns and villages inside Syria. And while many of these opposition groups all have the common theme that they want to oust the Bashar al-Assad regime, you know, many people have different ideologies at that. I think it's also important to note that many former regime elements who are very senior and have taken part in suppressing the Syrian people over the last 40 years are now trying to lay claim and call themselves opposition, which is so far from the truth. These people, such as Abdel Halim Khaddam,
Some of them may actually be working for the Syrian regime still.
Yeah, and many of them will still be working for the regime still as double agents per se. There's also Rifat al-Assad, the brother of former Hafez al-Assad, who now considers himself
Bashar
for the last few years.
Bashar al-Assad's uncle,
who considers himself in opposition. But these people are laughed at. It's also important to note that the Syrian people will not accept an externally fabricated opposition. And this is an important thing to note for the international community and also those who are trying to lay influence in the nation.
Well, Fareed Ghadri, let me take this back to you. You're with the Reform Party of Syria. I mean, you've seen what's happened in other countries. You see some of the turmoil going on in Egypt and the militias rising in Libya that they say are tearing that country apart. Could some of these diverse arguing opposition groups in a post-Assad Syria, again, that's an assumption, could that lead into further struggles? Could it lead to just struggles between the opposition groups themselves?
Well, democracy is about diversity. Democracy is about people exchanging views, debating issues, and negotiating deals. So I see the diversity of Syria as an advantage, not at a disadvantage. What we need to do is make sure, or the international community, help the Syrian people inside and outside come to terms with the vision of what Syria ought to be or what Syria needs to be, and then agree on that vision collectively and work with the people of Syria to actually implement all the, you know, that vision. I think the diversity is an advantage, is an opportunity, as a matter of fact, rather than a liability for us at this point.
Does make it messy, though. That's Fareed Qadri, Syrian-born co-founder and president of the U.S.-based Reform Party of Syria. Also still with us, Sohrab Ojicakli with the National Alliance of Syria. Sohrab, what are you hoping for Syria? Are you hoping for a constitution and a democratic government, which is popularly elected? Are you hoping for a more of a monarchy-based thing? What do you see the country becoming?
The vision of this revolution is grounded in recognizing and embracing a pluralistic society founded on democratic principles. That's what this revolution is all about. It's about freedom. It's about dignity. It's about ousting any sort of mafia-style corruption in the nation. And I think at the end of the day, what we're all hoping for and what we know is that this revolution will at the end of the day succeed. It's just a matter of time and how many Syrians will die in the process.
After that revolution succeeds, as you've seen in other countries, it's still messy.
It will get messy, but that's our mess to clean up. For 40 years, the Syrian people have suffered, and it will take a little bit of transition time, I think, post-Assad. But that's what the Syrian people are willing to do. And what we've seen over the last 10, 11 months is that there are thousands of young Syrians all around the country who are willing to put their lives on the line to support this future vision of a free and democratic Syria.
Sohrab Ojicakli, co-founder of the National Alliance of Syria Pro-Democracy Group. Thank you so much. You've been with us all hour long. Also, Fareed Qadri with the United States-based Reform Party of Syria. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you very much.
To get to that revolutionary moment, how many people in Syria will have to die? Let's leave you with that thought. We can speak freely here about the future of Syria, and we must be grateful for that. Meanwhile, inside that country, behind the curtain of violence and isolation enforced by the regime of Bashar Assad, people cannot speak so freely about the future, even if they believe they have one. We leave you with the latest dispatch from a cameraman working right now in the besieged city of Homs this morning. Holding his camera, standing in front of a pile of rubble in the city of Homs. Finally, the words of Syrian poet Nizar Kabani about his beloved Damascus. I've come to you from the laughter of Syrian women that first taught me music in the beginning of adolescence, from the first sprouts of our alley that first taught me crying, and from my mother's prayer rug that first taught me the path to God. Damascus, what are you doing for me? I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.